Jake, can I say I have a slightly difficult job here to try and explain why the AFU I think did relatively well when we missed most of our targets. So I wanted just to take a moment to take you back a little bit over the last few years. The first slide, I think, is the figures got a little bit messed up on this slide, but I think it's just intended to show that both our targets, which are the yellow lines on those graphs, and our actual outputs have grown very rapidly over the first 10 or 11 years of the AFU. But in the last 2 years, as you can see, both the red lines at the top have taken a decided downwards trend. And I think that downwards trend is mainly ascribed to two factors. The one is that over the last 3 years, the number of operational staff in AFU have actually declined by about 19%. So those are the people who actually have to do the work to get orders in court. And it has been aggravated by the impact of the budget. I think the second issue is that we have been able to replace some of the staff recently, but they are obviously new people to the job, and it is not going to, it's going to take a little bit of time for them to become fully productive. But I think maybe I should just add that, you know, the reasons why we were able to get the steep increases before, it was a combination of additional resources and budget, plus the fact that we were able to make significant productivity gains over the years. And I think those are just not, has not been possible over the last two or 3 years. Just for those who actually look up the figures, the values on the left-hand graph is the combined total of freezing and confiscation orders, and the numbers on the other side also the combined total of both of those. On the next slide, Gordon, if it's working. I think you all know by now the purposes of the AFU, so I'm not going to deal too much with that. Just to say that we had requested last year and again this year that to Treasury to reduce some of our targets in line with our capacity. We were able to persuade them to some degree, but unfortunately I think we still sit with targets that are less than attainable. What we have tried to do internally is to focus our work on some of the bigger value cases, as I indicated last time when I was here, because at least that way we can meet some of our value targets, even if we can't meet the number targets. But the problem we had in the last year, that is what many of the bigger cases, as I think has been indicated earlier by Advocate Jiba, takes time to get ready and to get to court. So we have done a large amount of work in the last year that is only producing results, frankly, in this year. And without preempting what may happen this year, but I think generally this year our value targets are looking very good. On the next slide, then, to go through some of the details, I think on the number of forfeiture and confiscation orders, we got quite close to our target. We were just 1% below. We actually managed to do a bit more than last year. A lot of that was thanks to good cooperation from the DPPs. We were able to do a lot more of the Section 18 applications in magistrates' courts, particularly in Cape Town. I think that has really helped us. I think on the restraint and preservation orders is really where our staff probably spend 60 or 70% of their time working on those orders, and I think that's where the reduction in capacity has hit us very hard, and it is at the moment just not possible for us to meet those targets, unfortunately. On the next slide, on the value of completed orders, there we were, as you can see, well below target and the previous year. This year, a couple of our big orders from last year had got delayed, so this year our figures are actually looking pretty good. We're about 40% above target at the moment, but last year we suffered. Similarly with new freezing orders, again this year is looking particularly good. Just to give you an indication, we are working at the moment on freezing orders to the value of more than R1.5 million. So we do think we're going to be far over target if we can get all of those things in court. But I'm not necessarily promising because a lot of our work does depend on our other stakeholders. I think one of the issues I'll touch on at the moment is that we have a large part of the freezing orders we are obtaining now are in big corruption cases, and last year it was 68% of the value of our freezing orders in those cases. On our overall success rates, we had our target increased quite a lot, but we did manage to beat it. So at least there was one of our five key targets that we were able to exceed. I think the work on the corruption cases, as I said, is one of our more success stories, and I think a lot of that is to do with the anti-corruption task team, where we're working very closely together with the Hawks and with the prosecution service. The target we were set in the JCPS delivery agreement was to freeze assets of 100 persons in that category of cases over 5 million, and to, by the end of March next year, to have frozen 1.5 billion in corruption cases. Last year we did 23 persons. That brought our total to 95, so we are confident that we are going to exceed that 100 by some margin. But also on the value of the orders, we did manage to bring a lot of big orders last year, so our cumulative total of what we've frozen in the last 3 years in big corruption cases has now hit 1 billion rand. We may even just make 2 billion rand this year if all goes well. So I think that is the one bit of good news in our performance. On the JCPS corruption cases, I think as Dr. Kujiba said earlier, we did manage to do 8 of those. Our target was 10. It was really just that very few cases came to us where it was worth doing a freezing order, as you can see reflected in the values of those orders, which was just 400,000. Payments to victim of crime, again, that's sort of one of the value targets do fluctuate quite a lot for us. Last year we paid 93 million to victims of crime. This year some of those cases were delayed, but we have already just about hit 55 million this year. So again, I think on the value front we're pretty confident that we're going to meet our targets. And some of the number targets, as I said earlier, is going to be a challenge for us. It was suggested that we also should just do a slide a little bit on what the AFU delivers in terms of a return on investment. We are one of the few state institutions that actually do bring in cash for government. And I don't think our intention was ever to operate at a profit, but at least we have come close to breaking even a lot of the time. We've just done a calculation over the last 6 years when our budget, average, we've brought in about 90 million a year, and those are actual payments to victims or payments into the criminal assets recovery account. Our budget over that period was about 95 million. Our first 6 months of this year, the thing has been good. So we already, while our budget is 112 million this year, we've already brought in 132 million in the first 6 months into CARA and victim payments. And I think there is a steady stream of recoveries that are being made in some of the big corruption cases. So I promise my colleagues that I'm going to be 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and I think I've managed to be 10.
Thank you, Chair. With your permission, I invite the CEO to do a presentation on the sources.
Thank you very much. most of what we're doing, some of it has already been mentioned by Kachiba, and it's all contained in the annual report. It's just some areas we'd like to point out to you. Just on this slide, if you could just please look, because there are some changes to the slide that you were given. Unfortunately, some of the figures were incorrect, and that relates to last year's figures that were incorrect. So last year, the number of posts, because actual establishment or number of posts is not as important as the number of filled posts. So in 2011-12, we had 5,012 bodies, you could say. And at the end of 12-13, we had 4,972, with also a decline in the contract posts. And this is one of the reasons why we have the same impact on our ability to perform as an organization. If we go to the next slide, we just give you a high-level breakdown. It is in the annual report also of the kind of training that we provided. We still rely heavily on Justice College from the sister or mother department to provide training that is also offered to us free of charge by Justice College. They put the bill for us. And then other legal programs. So in total, 4,300 people were trained. And the main focus, of course, was on ensuring that prosecutors received the relevant training identified by the various training forums in the offices of the Director of Public Prosecution. Bursaries, we are very active in encouraging our staff members to study once again. Our main focus is ensuring that people obtain the legal qualifications. We still had a lot of prosecutors that didn't have RLB, as I mentioned at the last occasion, and some still with tribunals. We're making inroads into that with a number of bursaries, 273 that were provided in that field, and we're really encouraging people to get an RLB because we believe that for a professional organization, we'd like to see people getting that. Other areas there also, and we do have some masters and doctorates that are also being studied by a number of our staff members. We go to the next slide. Interns, as you know, we had budget constraints, so in the last financial year we didn't have any interns. In the current financial year we will have about 100 interns that will be taken in, and we have been assisted in this regard by SOSICA, and the full name of that acronym, State Agency,
Thank you.
That's for the SOSICA that provides us with some funding and assistance in that regard. Added to that, I just think we must also just touch on the aspirant prosecutor program. As you know, due to our budget constraints, we have been unable to proceed with that program in the current financial year. However, through continued forced savings in our goods and services, we have made additional funding available to our compensation and employee budget, and we will be finalising the intake by 1 November of a further 50, and in the new financial year we hope to by February have a further intake through a new advertising process of the people that graduate this year to take another 50 people on board so we can increase our staff establishment in the organisation the most effective way. Those are the areas in which we have taken interns in the past. Grievances and other disciplinary matters, we give you a breakdown, previous ones, please, Gordon. Just a breakdown there of the one before, Gordon. Yes. Just in terms of the disciplinary hearings, 78 hearings, of which 56 were concluded. We give you the details in respect of that. Pending, and we give you the trend there in the compared to the previous year. 2011-12, we do know we did have a lot that was part of our drive to get a clean audit. A lot of it related to financial matters, irregular expenditure, etc., which we found that due to that in 2012-13, we actually didn't have to discipline anybody, I think, or relatively few people for that due to the action that had been taken to get compliance in the organisation in the previous year. The next slide, we just talk a little bit around the percentage of the staff, people that are involved in grievances. 264, the bulk of those grievances still relate to the individual performance management and the process that is followed there in throughout the organization. 884 were resolved and 80 are still pending. Many of these are that were lodged in the last month of the financial year. Misconduct cases, as I said, we had 78 hearings, 56 were finalized, 40 were guilty with sanctions, 16 were not guilty or were withdrawn. And external disputes, we have a very high success rate that indicates the efficiency of our labor relations processes as well, with an 88% success rate to the organization. Precautionary suspensions were 14, and suspension as a sanction there were 7, and dismissals there were 8, of which 6 of those relate to corruption related offences, soliciting bribes, and they were all prosecuted. The next slide, we just give you a breakdown for your interest to look at the race and gender and the percentage thereof within total population in our organisation and the population within that race and gender. I don't want to dwell on that too much, it's just more for interest for you. Then the misconduct by type, you'll note there's a typo on your slide, it's 81, not 83. And you'll notice we did 78, but the added the 3 for poor performance, you just indicate that we did do 3 for poor performance as well. And you can look at the various types of misconduct that we're dealing with. Concerning, of course, to us is the dishonesty, the corruption, bribery, which is 19, and which is 23% of our cases. But if you look at the total number of our staff in the organisation, then that is actually a very small figure, and it's also being testimony to the fact that within the organisation, the managers have really taken to heart the focus by the JCPS on eradicating corruption within our ranks. So there's a real focus on this, and this is the result thereof that these cases are being brought to the fore. Audit findings, I'll just briefly deal with it. As the Kijiba has touched on that, then you can get a brief history of the organisation and where we've come to it. The road to a clean audit is not a one-year process. It has taken us the last 3 years of concerted working towards this goal, and it is something we're very proud of. It is, I think this morning gives a clear indication of the complexity around and of that environment and the magnitude of the achievement that we've got. From my side, also just to say that this is not a finding that reflects only on corporate services, but is one that reflects on the leadership of the organisation under Ejiba and every manager within the organisation that did a concerted effort to ensure that we achieve a clean audit. It's not a single person's achievement. Then, if it's okay with the NDPP, if the executive manager takes us through the budget.
Through your chair.
Slide just indicates the expenditure outcome as at the end of the financial year. It's before the final environment. So these figures are different from those published in the annual report. You'll see there that if we didn't do the environment, we would have overspent compensation of employees with 33 million rand. That's why we forced the savings on goods and services, machinery and equipment, and interest income from that, in order to make sure that we pay all our officials at the end of the financial year. So the next slide is just the allocation of the EMP budget allocation for the vote. This is the justice vote. If you look at program 4, which we are the National Prosecuting Authority, you will see that our MTF allocation over the MTF period, the MTF is the medium-term expenditure framework, only grows at 5% on average in comparison to other programs such as court services, which grows at a significant bigger percentage. Then, as far as the MTF budget allocation for 2012-13, the next MTF is concerned, this is the indication as to which program within the NPA receives what kind of funding. Our focus is on the core business, national prosecutions, the services, national specialized prosecutions. As a forfeiture, Mr. Hoffman made reference to the budget cuts. Those budget cuts were affected in 10-11. It was significant. It was about a 30% cut in his budget. So that now his baseline is growing steadily. So then, this is a new slide, so I apologize for this. We added this to indicate the request we submitted to National Treasury for additional funding. We have requested National Treasury for an additional 897 million rand over the MTF. This is all basically for increase in capacity. There are indications there of what, in which units these capacity is required. It's basically throughout the MTA. From our feedback from National Treasury, the indications are that we would not be very successful to if we make it maybe 27 million additional to baseline, but it's not confirmed yet. It's the AEME process is not completed yet. We have asked for an additional 897 million as of the MTN, and the indications are that we may get 27 million additional. Look, the consequences of this is that we will not be in a position to create any new posts, and as posts become vacant, they become unfunded, and then we have a prioritization process in terms of which we need to determine which post is more critical than the other one, and then we fill those depending on funding availability. We also, I believe, have reached a limit of our ability to reprioritize funds from goods and services to compensation of employees. The current ratio for goods and services to compensation of employees is 16%. If we continue moving funds from goods and services to compensation, we will sit with resources on boxes, being unable to do any work because we will not be able to provide them with pens, telephones or anything.
Thank you for that, and it's quite a lot. Let's see if we can do justice to our engagement. Ms. Swartz.
Chairman, I'd like to start with a question on the Murphy judgment. Mm-hmm. I have other questions, but I will ask only this one now because I'm quite sure that other members will want to take it further. And this question goes directly to our new national director. I'm very pleased to meet you, sir. I'd like to start off by saying, as you know and as I know, that Murphy has set aside the withdrawal of the charges of fraud and corruption, etc., against Sir Richard and Julie. He has set aside the withdrawal of the murder, kidnapping and so forth charges against Mr. Ngudi. It is therefore your duty to reinstate the prosecution or reinstitute the prosecution. And if that is not what you are going to do, I ask you please to advise us and to ask the public what it is you are then contemplating doing. I took note of what you said, that you wished to apply for mine. But the judge has given us something very straightforward on the grounds that justice needs to be done. Very straightforward. And I would respectfully suggest, A, that you should act upon it, because the judgment seems to me impregnable, as in the fortress that can't be reached. Or secondly, that you advise very soon what it is you are there for contemplating. But sir, with respect, I think your problems go beyond this, because the judge also made various findings that relate to the officers of the National Prosecuting Authority. I had a special appreciation for the fact that you here said this morning to us that you have taken an oath to fulfill your functions without fear or favour. It is therefore your intention and your earnest intention to do just that. You, however, have officers in the NPA who have been found, and I quote from paragraph 237 of the judgment, the NDPP, by which he was referring to the acting NDPP, madame, and the DPP, and I note you have brought along the DPP's North and South Khartoum today, they have not demonstrated exemplary devotion to the independence of their officers or the expected capacity to pursue this matter without fear or favour. The judge found in particular that from the bullet that was brought to the office of the acting NDPP to exercise her powers of review, which in his view have been resulted only in a foregone conclusion. In ordinary English it would have been a waste of time, because in his view she had evinced an attitude of approval, in other words, So there is a problem right there. In the case especially of the DPP, who first, during the disciplinary inquiry of Advocate Bakenbach, testified that he had indicated that he did not approve of the withdrawal. A special director like Advocate Brewebi, of course, can't take a decision like this without consulting the DPP. The DPP Noordhagen first did one thing, but later, in an affidavit to the court, that he ultimately concurred with Advocate Brewebi. The judge, as a result, rejects his testimony as, I quote, uncreditworthy. And uncreditworthy is a very polite word. It is used throughout the judgment. And I think that we have served with respect the problem if the most senior officers of the National Prosecuting Authority have findings of uncreditworthiness against them. I would dearly like to hear from you. I suspect you're going to tell me you're not ready to answer, but I would dearly like to hear from you not only what you're going to do with the findings of the case, but also what you're going to do in respect of your officers. And I draw special attention to Advocate Mudwebi, who, I'm not going to recite the whole history of how he managed to withdraw these charges, render himself fructus officio, but I draw your attention also, and then now this is, if you like, hearsay, but it's from the press, to the fact that Mail and Guardian asserted at some point that it had seen documentation proving that it was also Advocate Mudwebi who was behind the withdrawal of charges in KwaZulu-Natal, those against the MEC Mabuyakulu and the Speaker Nkonyeni. So I mean, I think we have a problem with the National Prosecutor's Authority. The South African public deserves to be able to have faith in its highest prosecuting officers. We have at last now a judgment. Advocate Jiva will remember that the last time we discussed this matter in enormous depth in April of 2012, and I asked her outright whether people had tried to interfere politically. She said to me, admirably, that as prosecutors, you are all expected to act without fear or favour, and that it would be a sad day if you succumbed to political pressure. You assured me that there had never been any instruction of a political nature to anyone. In the event, as matters have unfolded, we've seen that there was a lot of interference from intelligence quarters, in fact. So it may be the case that we're looking at the rogue sect bureaucracy rather than political interference. But here we are. We finally have a judgment that says after me very clearly what occurred. I think it is a real problem when the intelligence services think that they are beyond any criminal action by the prosecuting authority. The IGI, Advocate Fatima Bebe, said quite clearly in her letter, which we also discussed last day, that it is simply wrong to argue that the NPA has no remit in respect of plain old-fashioned criminal activity and that you should prosecute. Now the judge has also said you should prosecute. And I would be really sorry, sir, if you didn't. Thank you.
Thank you, and also again our congratulations from our side to the new Attorney General, being an attorney. I'd just like to continue the line of questioning from Ms. Smuts, and just again, it is an issue where there seems to be quite a clear directive from the court, which would seem to indicate to me that the only thing that needs to be decided is whether there will be an appeal against the judgment or not. But I think it does, the assertions and the findings of the court are an issue of great concern, and as you know, it is in the public domain, and I'd like to hear from you what steps you would take to address those issues that have been raised in the judgment. Yes, you are new, and it will take you some time to look at that, but clearly there are some management issues, and if there are allegations of interference from the intelligence sector, that is a major concern, and we would urge you to look into that and, if necessary, come back to us and let us as Parliament assist you if necessary. Yes, you are an independent body. You are, and we don't at all want to intervene politically, but we also need to assist you when it comes to legitimacy in the eyes of the public as an institution. So feel free that when you come to us, if there is any issues that we need to take cognizance of, we should be able to do that. Chair, I want to raise a few general questions, if I may as well. Again, well done to the NPA under Steva for the clean audit and the financials, and we do appreciate the severe financial constraints that the NPA is operating under. And therefore, as this committee has before, I think, Chair, it is incumbent upon us to look very carefully during this BBR process as to how we can assist the NPA with that 890 million over the medium term. And Chair, it is shocking to me that the indications are that only 27 million will be granted over a 3-year period. We know the levels of crime in society, and the NPA is at the forefront of that. And I think it is it correct for us to ask in detail questions about performance when, at the end of the day, Parliament approves the budget? So I mean, to a certain degree, I have great sympathy when it comes to performance. If we are not, as Parliament, granting the funds, then surely we can't expect them to keep increasing their performance. And so, Chair, but that having been said, that we need to look at that in our report. And I would suggest that when we do come to that, that we do approach the Appropriations Committee and the Finance Committee and follow that process and take it a step further. Chair, so when one looks at the admissions that were made about the overall performance against the predetermined target, where the NPA admitted is not satisfactory, do that against the backdrop of financial constraints. So I want you to just ask a particular issue, and that relates to an issue of concern that we've expressed before, and that is the informal mediation, the ADRs. And I think we have expressed our concerns about that. But if one looks, for example, at your slide 20, and if your slide 20 indicates your performance or court efficiency 08-09 year, where your verdict cases were 350,000 and your ADRs were 81,000, this year your verdict cases are 323,000 and your ADRs are 143,000. So Chair, if you take that parallel, then in a space of 4 years your verdict cases have in fact gone down and your ADRs have increased substantially. Now I appreciate the regulatory framework for the Child Justice Act and the diversions that occur in that regard, but I really ask you to explain to us, if you can, that 143,000 ADR is the informal process. How does it work? And we did see there is corruption in the NPA. There are some NPAs, prosecutors that are being charged. Does it not open one to corruption when you have an informal mediation process that isn't regulated? And what does it entail? I appreciate, and I'm a propounder for or an advocate for restorative justice, but if there isn't, what are the sufficient checks and balances when it comes to informal mediation? I'm not talking about the diversion process. That's very strict. But that seems to be 143,000 seems to be quite high. And I just asked, we did raise it before, and it might well be working wonderfully, but it just seems to me it's a very broad area, grey area. And is it in fact the local prosecutor at the bottom that can sit with a complainant and say, sort this out, or how does it work in practice? Chair, the issue, again against the backdrop of financial constraints, we are looking at the dedicated courts for sexual offences, and we indicated when we dealt with the bill a degree of urgency. It has been announced and we indicated that the work is continuing, but that needs to be done as quick as possible. Now, it is obviously a concern when part of that process would be two prosecutors dedicated to that, and it seems that the budgetary constraints will again inhibit that process. So I wanted to ask the NDPP what impact, or one of his assistants, will it have on the special dedicated sexual offences courts if you do not have those two prosecutors? How will it impact on the prosecution? Because clearly, as has been indicated, the prosecution of sexual offences, rape in particular, requires experienced and specialised prosecutors, and if we don't have those two prosecutors, what impact is it going to have? The issue of your prosecution on corruption, and I appreciate 42 out of 50 the target, one is looking at 5 million rand, but if the excuse for not meeting the target is that the matters are complex and take too long to finalise, has this not always been the case? And I'm just a bit concerned, serving on other committees, on the financial committee, for example, that one gets the impression that as the national budget is increasing with 1 trillion rand, and your extent of corruption is increasing annually, that we don't seem to be able to meet the prosecution of corruption cases. And again, the answer is, I suppose, clearly financial constraints. But maybe you could just assist me with understanding that, together with the issue of fewer cyber crimes reaching the courts. Now that is also seems, what would the reason for that be? Where you have increasing usage of internet banking, increasing usage of computers, it seems strange that there are fewer cyber crime matters reaching the courts. Against the background of corruption, it's very alarming that the asset forfeiture unit, due to capacity constraints, is not able, in my view, to meet its targets. Although we see 1 billion rand, that is commendable, but to fully realize its potential. And it just makes sense to me that if you want to fight corruption, that you've got to ensure that your asset forfeiture unit and other units, your NPA, have the sufficient capacity. Spend more money on them and they will have show the returns. So, Chair, that is something that I feel very strongly about as well. So, Chair, somehow we need to find a way to support the requirement or the request. Clearly, 897 will not be achievable, 897 million, but 27 million, I think, is regrettable.
Yeah.
And just lastly, as a general comment, I'm trying to gauge whether there's improvement or not in our, and it's very difficult to gauge in the prosecution of crime when one doesn't have the police stats as to how many cases are reported, where are we, in comparatively speaking, and yes, the police stats were released and and you know that there are so many million cases that are reported, so many are withdrawn, so many are not investigated. But just on that fact of your conviction rate, it doesn't seem, if one compares from 08-09 to now, that there is a substantial increase in the number of verdict cases. And those are cases that are taken to trial and where you have a judgment whether guilty or not guilty. 08-09, 350,000. This year we've got 323,000. Is there an explanation for that, given that over that 4-year period, crime stats have definitely increased? Thank you, sir.
Chairperson, let me also welcome and congratulate the new national director. And say that one observes that he's surrounded by capable men and women, so we have no doubt that there is capacity to do things that we are expecting them to do. But I'm just concerned that their biggest problem could be ourselves. Because over time, we have accumulated mistrust in institutions of government. including the NPA. And we are suspicious of political interference, and therefore we may end up giving prejudging people before they start doing their work. You know, it was quite clear in the input of the national director that he wants to apply his mind. Now, we ourselves are already saying, tell us what you are to do, you are going to do. Which means that he must apply his mind now and in this room. We are also, some of us, some are experienced, some are lawyers. We know that when a judgment has been handed down, there is room for appeal. And before people are given an opportunity to decide whether they are going to appeal or not, we say, how are you going to implement the judgment? So I just get a sense that we are beginning to be unfair, even in this room. I actually thought that, in fact, when we say act without fear, favor, or prejudice, we should also include without political pressure. And therefore that this committee should not put pressure and set the pace for the NPA to say, you do this within this time frame. So I hope that, as it was suggested, that at this point we will actually assist the leadership of the NPA to move forward without using the baggage of the past as if is their baggage. But the second point I want to make is I'm not sure if this alternative dispute resolution mechanisms are meant to give effect to what the Constitution refers to as other forums. And if that is so, I am just wondering whether in deciding on these mechanisms, we in fact take into account the fact that we are an African country on the southern tip of the African continent. Because some of these mechanisms are actually imported from other countries, Canada and so on and so on. And there was a point in the 80s when people in the country came up with their own forums, like community courts and so on. And the president himself spoke about indigenization of the law. Judge Hopper spoke about the Africanization of the law. So one would suggest that maybe when we talk about this alternative informal structure, we also look at what their traditions and cultures can contribute in developing those structures and the new jurisprudence that should inform. But otherwise, Chairperson, I know that we have the freedom to speak and to ask questions. But I just want to appeal that I don't think we should set an agenda and time frames in this meeting as to how judgments are going to be implemented, because unless and until a decision has been taken not to appeal, so that's the decision is still open to question. So so we can't say definitely it must be implemented and this must be the time frame. Thank you.
Good morning,
thank you, Chair. Just to welcome the National Director of Public Prosecution and to welcome the report that has been given. And to say yes, indeed, we do wish to actually extend our support to others. Another part has indicated that you need to come to us. We need assistance. And we accept the fact that you, in terms of the questions that you've been asked, you wish to continue to apply your mind. Don't feel under pressure. Of course, the questions are crucial. But like you've indicated, you need to apply your mind and allow you to give us. On the other hand, in terms of the reports that have been given, I wish to just add to what Honorable Mutaha has indicated. Your statistics should actually link to the crime in the country. You indicate that it was better to indicate that, for example, that in terms of the conviction rate, what is your impression of the types of crimes in South Africa, and that indeed should actually talk to them about the APS statistics. Like, for example, also when you talk about sexual offences, you can indicate also that in of the so many reported cases of sexual offences, so many have been finalized, but slide number 34, for example. It actually gives you a clear picture of what is happening, whether what we are doing is actually giving any form of effect, an impact or not. And the same would go to the issue of the number of child offenders. If you indicate that on slide 44, that so many have actually been diverted, it would be of the total number of child offenders, 2.8%, which actually articulates to itself, which is an increase, has actually been diverted as compared to the previous year. It helps to actually demonstrate the serious state of affairs in the country, the work that you're doing, and how your work that you're doing is actually having an impact on what the country needs to do about problematic areas. The same would go to the judicial centers. It will be important to indicate also what type of cases mostly are the women who get to sell at care centers are experiencing, and even the type of support system that is there, because you just don't just put them in the care centers. I'm sure there's some programs that are actually going on there. Just to have an idea of what is happening, rather than just getting the statistics. In terms of asset forfeiture, it's good for us to talk about the loads of money that we get from asset forfeiture. But at the same time, I was just listening to the current thing. Billions and billions of nothing makes more billions. And I'm saying to my husband, wait a minute, these targets, the way we want to reach the targets, are we just doing it in order to reach the targets, or when we actually address a problematic situation? So you shouldn't strive for money, making more money, but maybe at the end of the day, find that maybe we are actually doing something. What just came to my mind quickly, I'm Christian Nicodemus, looking for the exits. You know, it feels like the strategy is something like that. Of course, when people do wrong, it's the measure of addressing corruption. We need to address corruption, and we need to address corruption viciously. But at the same time, whatever we do should be something that plays to us as a country, we are doing it correctly. There's not going to be anybody who's going to be, who's going to be a casualty, because we want to reach a target. I don't know whether it makes sense. And I would actually just like to have a comment on this. And that actually goes to our performance indicators, how we articulate them in relation to our own mandate and goals, and whether this is the right measure that we are utilizing. I just want us to utilize the measure, the performance measure. Thank you.
To the new NDPP, I also want to say very welcome. I have to say that initially I actually hope that it's going to be a woman. I do think that once women are appointed, things get done faster, but that's just my opinion. I want to know from you, I mean, we don't know you, we don't know how you work. You've obviously read through the Murphy judgment, and without putting pressure on you, can you tell me what would you regard as a reasonable time for you to apply your mind? I mean, 2 weeks have passed. Are we going to wait another 2 weeks? Are we going to wait a month? Are we going to wait for another court judgment? Can you just give us some sense of how long should we wait before you apply your mind? I also know you're hardly here for a month now. Can you tell me in your own assessment of the NPA, what do you regard as critical challenges of the NPA? Because from where we are sitting, we all have our own views of what is critical in the NPA and what is not. My next question is to Ms. Jiba. I've read a newspaper report, it was a news report 2 days ago, about you that have allegedly stopped an investigation of maladministration, favoritism and abuse of office regarding the KZN DPP, Ms. Mapoina Noko. Can you give us clarity on that? Is it the truth, or is it just nonsense, or what is going on there? So can you please give us the status of that in this investigation, if it exists? My next question is to Mr. Ramaita. I hope I pronounced his surname properly. There was also a recent report about the investigation of Dr. Neil Agate's case, and that it's still under investigation. I mean, that was a year ago. Can you tell us, I mean, the TRC report has been out for many, many years, and government isn't really giving an indication whether they intend to pursue any of those cases at all. Can you indicate to us whether it's still worth waiting for as South Africans, whether there will be any prosecutions? I know Ms. Makeke have indicated, even with Dr. Agate's case, that the NPA must still decide whether to prosecute or not. I mean, it's now a year. There's other matters as well. What is the status of it? Why can't we just settle that report? General questions. I've noticed that there's only 3 cases with regards to rhino poaching, and this is something that has been on TV basically every day. Is it something that the NPA regards as serious? What is its plan, and how come we don't have any steps with regards to that? My last question is just with regards to the NPA's plan regarding STEPS. I mean, STEPS is the organization that needs to do investigations, but when it comes to matters where STEPS are actually involved, what is your strategy around that? And I'm thinking in particularly where there was a recent service delivery process as well, and then a 17-year-old girl got killed. Now, we obviously don't know what happened there. There was no clipping like with Andre Satani, but without casting aspersions on anybody, I just want to know, what is your strategy? Because this is not isolated matters. You do hear about these kind of things regularly in the media, and if you have to rely on SEPs, and SEPs is also implicated, what is your strategy around that? Thank you.
Can I give you the microphone for the questions?
second round. Can I ask a few questions? I'm doing this partly on behalf of Advocate Polonisa, who had to leave us because he had a medical appointment this afternoon. If I may refer you to slide 28. Where you say legal representatives often request demands far into the future. And Advocate Holomis and I chatted about it very briefly just before we broke for lunch. So I'm asking these questions arising from that discussion. Would it be correct for me to say that postponements are too easily granted? And would it also be correct and fair to say that postponements equate more money for lawyers appearing in these courts, or are these generalizations in that part? Then thirdly, what steps, if any, envisaged by the NPA to address and finally, just by way of information for my purposes, what is the role of the presiding officer in this case? You know, we keep hearing these cliches about justice denied and speedy resolution of cases and so on. The sense I get is the presiding officer is ever too keen to grant postponements in adjournments, perhaps because he or she is afraid of being appealed. But, well, let me leave it there. And then, this is also a very broad but general question. More from your colleagues, Mr. Masala, is the quality of investigations and case dockets they receive. You see, we have you, and it's just you, appearing here before us, and we throw these questions at you and tell you that you're not doing enough, and your targets are dropped, and so on. And in fact, as you pointed out in your presentation, there are other role players. And I often wonder the level of satisfaction, and really I'm asking you to be open and honest with us with regard to quality of investigations and the quality of the case dockets that your prosecutors there in the district courts and regional courts, that they get and are expected to prosecute successfully. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I will start off by attempting to give answers to your questions, particularly questions raised on behalf of Advocate Holomis. This also based on my experience in courts. Whether the postponements are too readily granted and they equate to more money to lawyers appearing in court. This is a difficult question, and there is no hard and fast rule to answer this question, simply because the prosecution will do its best to have the matter enrolled and be tried in court. But obviously, as Advocate Kiba in her presentation alluded to the fact that the prosecution, unfortunately, is not the only role player in court, then the court will also have to balance the interests
the prosecution in the state, as well as the interest of the accused, as well as the interest of justice, whether to grant the postponement. Obviously, the presiding officer will have to be guided by all those interests and balancing all those interests. And if he or she finds that it is in the interest of justice, obviously, to grant the postponement, he or she will grant the postponement. Yes, often it is true that often the postponement are granted. And why the prosecution is but a component of the court process, unfortunately or fortunately, as far as I understand, the circumstances changed recently or in the recent past. Whilst we know that there is a term where we know that the prosecution, the state is dominant litigants, but when it comes to case flow management, the courts, being the presiding officers, have the ultimate say when they run the courts. Obviously, then that gives little powers to the prosecution in that regard. But the bottom line is the prosecution has to be granted based on whether or not it is in the interest of justice to grant the postponement. About whether or not the granting of the postponement is to make money to the lawyer appearing in court, Chair, I will not attempt to answer that, Chair, for fear of where I come from. I think I've also then attempted to answer what measures then does the NPA have in capping that in capping that and I have in my notes as I have explained that the presiding officer at the end of the day is the one who makes a decision. obviously, that would be advised by all the relevant factors that have alluded to. The quality of investigations and case dockets that the prosecution receives, I will defer that to my colleagues, but also in my experience as the having been practiced, that is one also of the problems that we have been complaining about, that the quality of investigations and the case dockets that we receive. Because sometimes you find that I know that there are in place in courts where they have established or identified or set aside courts that will deal specifically with the collating of investigations, preparing the courts, the docket for only when the court is ready for trial, then the court perhaps they just allocate a specific court to deal with that. But that I have found that sometimes in some instances you find that the case docket gets allocated to a trial court for trial, and that also may result in the postponement of further investigations, more especially if it were to come from the district court to the regional court, and the regional court prosecutor will be of the view that the matter has not been sufficiently investigated. But those problems don't occur more often, but they are there. I understand from my background. To answer the
questioned by the honourable member what is reasonable time to apply my mind. Obviously, the reasonable time will also be informed by the nature of the case or the cases in question. Obviously, if one were to apply his mind in cases which are so-called high-profile cases, obviously there is a bit of time. The time factor also will have to determine that I have to give myself enough time to apply my mind so that I make a proper decision in the matter. In short, then, reasonable time cannot be then measured as in days or weeks or months. Your question also on the political challenge that I've identified in the NPA, I would say the critical challenge that I have identified is to improve the credibility and the integrity of the NPA. That is the challenge that I've identified. to attempt also to answer the question or the advice, so to say, that we must have the statistics of the SAPS, and so that you can better be informed. I'll answer this based on the background that I have even before I joined the organization. Remember, we know that and the SAPS has been to before the portfolio committee where they tried to present the statistics, and they were sent packing. And obviously, one will have then to, if one were to rely on those statistics, obviously there is more work that we have to do in terms of working together with SAPS in order to verify the stats that they give us before we present them before this committee, so that we also not find ourselves in the same position where they have to be checked out and where the statistics are found to be wanting. But I understand with the JCPS cluster meetings, and I think that is going to happen because they are meeting. We meet. I have attended one on my first day, and I think that there will be that interrelationship. And I think also from what they reported, there is much improvement, and one basically is moving towards a position where their statistics can be relied on, so that we can also rely on and make a proper report. And when we make our report, Dr. Musekha, I don't know, because I had not prepared the response. I don't know where, how he read my mind, but he captured almost everything that I wanted to say regarding your questions, madam. Obviously, I do take note of what you and Mr. Swart have said about the Judge Murphy judgment. And I do take note also of the criticisms that he has made about senior members of the NPA. But obviously, one as a lawyer will also have to take cognizance of the fact that, as Dr. Musekha has correctly pointed out, that there are procedures also that are still to be followed. And as you were asking the question, I got the information that today a leave to appeal was filed, has been filed today. Therefore, then to deal with the matter, then to preemptive, because one will have then to, and that is the process that I already found there, and it is pending, it is there. I can then report that there is the leave to appeal has been filed.
And forgive me, but by the NPA?
Yes.
And this was in person, you just said, and this was already in process when you arrived?
That is correct. The process has been in place, but the filing aspect, I think, was done today. I think council was briefed to prepare it to appeal and the like, and that process was taking place, and leave to appeal has been filed today. Which then takes us back to the point that one will have then to allow the process, the legal process, to take its course. Obviously, if the leave to appeal has been filed, obviously, we know as lawyers that without second guessing what Judge Murphy has said, obviously his decision is then kept in abeyance until it is confirmed by the Superior Court.
Thank you for the information.
Thank you.
So, can I just ask a clarity or a clarity? This is mindful of our subjudicative rule.
No. Just to ask whether you participated in that decision or not, or was it already a decision that had been taken by the time you arrived? That's purely what I want. I'm not asking you to motivate the decision, but purely whether you participated.
I just wanted to. No, I think the NDP was just wrong, Dr. Macheche.
I accept your ruling. I just thought that maybe we should also not put people into situations which may also themselves be violating of the law. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sitting at the back, so I can't see properly.
No, he's still answering.
Okay. The question whether or not the national director participated. If you look at the judgment here, one of the issues raised was that when the Mr. Chauke took the decision, he had not consulted the national, the NDPP, which suggests to me that the body is seen not in terms of individual, that the leader is provincial official, and that when a decision is taken, there must be consultation, so that it must be a decision that is informed by all, and that therefore a question whether one participated in the decision of this nature may also be contrary to the understanding of what the NDP National Prosecution is. I just as a committee, maybe later we can look at some of these things so that we have a common understanding. Thank you.
But Chairman, it's a furious nonsense. You think these are very small chance.
All right, you see, I want us to allow the team here to respond to all our questions and comments. That's why we've asked them to be here. The debate now that you're asking us to enter into,
we can
do that, but you know, so much.
With respect, I didn't ask for a debate now.
Right.
I said I wanted to place something on record that we as a committee can have a look at.
Mr. Wasana, I'm not sure who and when. Dr. Ramayite, I don't want to recognize you until perhaps.
Yes, can I invite Dr. Ramayite to answer the question first?
Is that on something different? On the questions? Sorry, Chairperson.
There was a question directed at you.
I wanted to answer others
as well. Yes, of course.
Because as I noted them, I think
sure.
There were three other questions that were raised by Mr. Swart that
sure.
Might be relevant. I apologize, Chair.
No, it's fine.
The three questions that were raised by Mr. Swart, I think, the one related to the impact of the constraints on budget, specifically on the dedicated courts and their ability to fulfill their functions, and especially also in relation to the notion of two prosecutors per court. Certainly, the budget constraints will impact on improved performance in this course. And you will have noted in the very last slide that was shown by Mr. Hollandby with respect to the request that we have made. If I recollect well, I think the SOCA has actually requested an additional 38 million. I think we can verify that, but certainly we have requested. Now, obviously just a small portion.
Mm-hmm.
So if we are unable to get the full extent of the amount that we have requested, we will not be able to fulfill the commitment to prosecutors the court. And this will also actually impact on our desire to actually improve the conviction rate, especially in the Tutuzela care centers, as well as in dedicated courts. There has been a commitment on the part of the Department of Justice to actually bring back the dedicated courts. So if we start with the resources that we currently have, bearing in mind the increased focus, we may not be able to report any significant improvement in that respect. So certainly that is going to impact on our performance. The second question related to reduction in corruption, which is actually output three in terms of the JCPS delivery agreement, and whether in fact the explanation in relation to the complexity of the cases can actually be an acceptable explanation.
But I think one needs to look at that objective in context. As part of the JCPS delivery agreement, the target was actually 100%, and then the end date being next year, 2040. So you will notice that we actually set ourselves a target of 50, which is actually half of the 100 that we set out. So for the current cycle that we are reporting on, we have achieved 42%, which is well less than the 50%. Now what we are trying to push for is to actually reach the target by next year. We are really trying as hard as we can, but the initial focus was not so sharp. But I do think that now there is a far much sharper focus, and especially bearing in mind that we've got a limited period left before we actually reach the 2014. So we are hopeful. There is now more concerted effort on the part of the regional offices in the SEC to try and reach that target. Complexity is just one of the factors, but it is not the only factor. And then was, I think, also the issue of why fewer cybercrime reaching the courts. Now, if you look at slide 58, which actually gives out performance in respect to prosecutions in cybercrime, the actual focus started in 2011-2012, and at that time there hasn't been a much focused approach in the prosecution of these cases. So it's not surprising that the first year, 2011-2012, we actually have much higher. Now we have been actually now reducing those cases. So it's been going down. But then the surprising thing is why now we don't have any more of this. The explanation for this is our experience has been that we actually didn't have experienced prosecutors. So the first challenge was to actually train the prosecutors. And then once we have done that, once we have increased the ability of prosecutors to do those cases, now the problem turned out with the investigators, especially with respect to IT forensic specialists. We have very few of those in the country. And, your other colleagues from other jurisdictions will tell you that it's a very difficult thing to actually prosecute. You see, because you have to prepare and have the relevant admissible evidence. Now, simply to gather evidence with respect to cybercrime, unless you've got IT forensic specialists, it's very difficult. But what we are currently trying to do is now to focus on joint training between prosecutors and forensic investigators. But then again, one of the challenges with the police, a colleague of mine told me, as soon as some of these investigators actually become skilled, they get poached by the private sector because there's a lot of demand for their services. Yeah. And then, just now, finally, on the nil agent matter, I think that one also needs to understand this matter that are handled by the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit in context. These are matters that arise from the TRC report. And in a number of those cases, there were already dockets that had been opened, meta dockets and so on and so forth. And a number of them had actually been closed because there was insufficient evidence. Now, to complete the process, we then looked at the TRC report and any additional information that had since arisen, specifically with respect to the Neil Agate matter. That matter had actually already been closed. In other words, the criminal investigation had been closed. But then the name had been mentioned in the TRC report. And on doing an analysis of the specific matter, there was a decision actually to close the matter. But then subsequent to that, further information was provided in the form of representations, specifically from members of the family. Well, it was simply additional information. The question was whether that information can be turned into tangible evidence. Currently, we are not finding anything that
can be turned into tangible evidence. But we are still liaising with the providers of the additional information. So to that extent, the matter is still open. Now the question is whether, in fact, it's worth it, you know, keeping it alive, or whether we should close. We are faced with a similar situation in other cases. Now what we have actually now decided to do is to say, well, look, we need to give ourselves at least a year to close all the cases if it's at all possible. But then experience tells us that even in those cases we have closed, new information keeps coming forward. Now the question is, can you simply, you know, just ignore that information?
No.
So in most instances we actually refer the information to the police to pursue. Now if nothing further happens, you know, we leave it at that. So I think that's the explanation.
The ADR issue that I'm hearing.
Yes. Have all the questions been answered? No. I think there's a hand at the back there.
I just wondered if there could be an answer.
No, Chair, I wanted to respond to the ADRM question.
Okay.
Because I realized that it sort of didn't make it to the response.
The question by the Honourable Member Swart about whether ADRMs are properly controlled and managed. As a result of a concern raised by this committee, I think early last year, we took it back to the organisation and directives for informalization were actually prepared.
Oh,
and was signed off and they came into effect on 1 September last year.
In terms of the provisions captured in the directives.
I did not tell them they don't have to read
that
it.
That is
so. You never
did. My apologies.
Oh, I'm told by the NDPP, or rather by Advocate Jibasol and the CEO that actually a report in this regard was forwarded.
Yes, it was.
Yes, no, the problem lies there.
But it's actually a very, very comprehensive set of directives that I think would make Mr. Swartz quite happy.
Yeah.
So the question falls away.
But it's still a high number.
The number
is still a high number. But it's not, I'm not complaining about it. But it's a
all right.
Thank you. All right. Anything else? Any other questions that need to be answered?
Yeah, I think there was just one question about AFU and whether just focusing on the money is the only way to deal with corruption, to put it crudely. I don't think we are saying that. I think government's anti-corruption strategy is very comprehensive and it has a number of preventative elements in it. I think from the criminal justice side, though, our job largely is to try and catch people and take away the proceeds that they have accumulated through corruption. And I think the role of AFU for me is important because the financial motive in most cases in corruption is very, very important. If we don't reduce the financial motive, we will continue to see corruption growing rather than reducing. So I don't think it's the only answer. I think it's part of a much bigger package of measures that government has tried to adopt to try and deal with corruption more effectively.
And there's nothing more satisfying than to sit at home and watch on TV and announcing that the AFU has taken 5 million rand from some crime board or the other. It's extremely satisfying. From whatever angle you're looking at it. So that's just me.
Can I make a
follow-up? Yes,
you
may do a follow-up.
Yeah, in actual fact, I'm not really questioning the money that's supposed to be taken back from proceeds of crime. I'm questioning linking that with your performance and saying, I need to get more. And I'm saying, is it something that we can use to measure performance? And you have targets, by the way. And that's why I made that example of the Bible and the text. To say that we need to fight crime viciously. But also at the same time, as we fight crime, we shouldn't have casualties for the sake of raising the money for the target we've set for ourselves. And maybe something that you may not be in the position to get an answer for now, maybe you need to apply your mind to it. Because when you look at your performance indicators, try to interrogate this. Supposing we live in a clean society, I was going to say you're not performing. Because you were actually working towards a clean society. And should it become clean, how would you actually be in the position to demonstrate your performance? When in actual fact it means you're working, and the society is clean now. Yeah. You don't have those, you haven't managed to reach those tight targets. That's what I mean.
I'm not sure if Glenn's question that you answered.
Can
I have
it?
I want you.
Thank you, Andrew. Please stay to chair. The question that was asked, the other one related to our focus on the environmental law crimes, the rhinos and all of that. We do focus on that very much, so much so that in the various DPP offices, there are prosecutors assigned specifically to deal with those cases. Even though we might not have indicated the number of the cases that we have dealt with in the financial year, we can find that information if you require it. It is there available. Then the second question that you raised is the issue relating to the investigations against the DPP, alleged investigation against the DPP in the case. Thank you very much, Madam, for raising this question. It gives me an opportunity to clarify the position. Just by way of giving you the background, the complaints by prosecutors in the from KZN are very old. They date back from the era of our predecessors, Advocate Yanhan, Henning, Advocate Bigoli, and all of them. There have been complaints many years ago. And I do want to clarify that I was never informed when I acted as an entity that there were particular complaints and investigations against the DPP per se. What I do know was that there were these particular complaints, and some of which related to the issues around the performance bonuses and the rewards, and a lot of internal issues, basically. So to my mind, when I was told that, I was obvious that we cannot be hiring outside services to investigate internal affairs. It is on that score that I communicated with Advocate Mboni, but unbeknown to me that at the time there were other complaints that the CEO, that came to the CEO's attention that I was not aware of. For example, the issues of maladministration and all of those things. So, That, but to my knowledge, really, there isn't an investigation that was authorized against the DPP per se. The complaints are okay, the complaints that affect the management. There are minutes and memorandums that she had subsequently, that she had been forwarding to Advocate Matrewin, explaining how she is dealing with the internal issues that have been raised by the prosecutors in KZN. Then the other question that you raised, I'm not so sure if it has been covered.
Can I just make a follow-up on that? So the investigation that the CEO has been aware of, is it a new investigation and is it pending now? Has it been finalized?
The investigation is still continuing. The investigation is still continuing. It's still continuing.
We've just discussed ADR. Not so long ago, your statistics were not even broken down. as between, so therefore this is an advance, as between cases with a verdict and cases which have been sent elsewhere through ADO. Now, what I want to ask is, may we now start learning every time how many of the ADRs are diversions and how many are informal mediations? Unless that is somewhere here in the slides that I missed it. Did I miss it?
Yes.
All right. So you haven't got a breakdown on that. All right. And is anybody... All right. Thank you. That answers that one. I want to ask you something about the statistics, because it's a difficulty that continues, especially with the media effect. I think people have a feeling there's a lot of crime in the country. Then they hear at the other end of the criminal justice process that there are these wonderful conviction rates, 88%, 96% for felony protection. And I think people have a sense that things don't hang together. And I wanted to ask you just this simple question on slide 40. See, this is to me something understandable. On slide 40, which you have under case management, and your figures for 2012-2013, here are your new cases. Call them for argument's sake, well, they're 960. Of those, were removed 482. The remaining 466 were finalized. 323 were finalized with a verdict, and some were ADRM. So, to me, that looks as though of the 900,000 new cases, it's really one third that were finalized with a verdict, which is kind of a more credible way of presenting it. Do you know what I mean? But I suppose the difficulty comes in the fact that you don't reflect just new cases. Isn't that the case? That's exactly it. It's because cases take a long time and they keep growing through the system, and now you have this backdrop pushing from the back. But I think this, if one could take more of this approach, don't ask me how, I wouldn't know. But if one could take more of this approach, it's visibly credible, you can understand it, it means that only a third are actually getting there with a verdict. But it makes more sense. Because otherwise people are just lost, and we've touched it today upon the subject of communicating with the public, which is a very important thing. If you could achieve that one thing in the PPR, then it would be a great achievement. All right, so you confirm that's the difficulty. I want to ask you something that I care about very much. The Amending Act, which is going to give the NCA a greater financial and administrative independence. The minister gave you that bill in April of 2012. Have you sent this back to the ministry? Because every time I ask, you haven't. And I mean, I would think it would be in your very great interest. So why is a bill of such importance languishing in the NPA?
I think the question one of the members is about the NCA amendment and what the other two issues they covered. The bill was sent to the minister.
With what?
It was sent to the minister. And I can't remember what it was. And it did come back with a number of comments, which I then said that I'm a little bit comfortable in picking them, knowing that there is going to be a permanent head that is going to be appointed. In fact, one of the issues that he was raising there is that he would rather have this thing that he has got permanently for the organization, which is something that cannot be changed, that those decisions can never be taken by the person who's going to be a permanent head of the organization.
Yeah.
So it's
one of
things that are going to be on
the NPP
table.
Well, I assure you, sir, if you want to appoint it, because only in your own interest is by us, and it would be good for this
country. It's one of about 10,000 matters to deal with, but we do agree with this one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, of late, that's what we are doing. So, you know, when people carry, we interview and just take on a committee appointment. But we don't want to do that.
Certainly, we want to say to you that you can count on us. I
sure and responsible group of MPs and other people can attest to that as well. And the opportunity for posturing is very limited here. And so we come to accept that and we're okay with it. So, you know, you can count on our support. Of course, you can also count on our criticisms when we feel it's necessary. But we enjoyed having all of you here with us today. And long may it last. Thank you. And we're done for the day.
I mean it, though, that you have something you want to discuss with us.